Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week I am delighted to present to you once again our resident neurologist and banjo aficionado, Josh Turkner, MD. Josh is back on the podcast with me to talk about the premise behind his Ancestral Health Symposium 2019 talk, How to Win at Angry Birds. It's a paradigm for how best to approach health and performance and has far-reaching implications that will help you simplify efforts to optimize your health. In this interview, Josh talks about his four-quadrant model, a detector for finding a signal in the health noise. In an age where specialization and technology have become the norm, and the next health trend is just around the corner, it's easy for the big picture to be obscured. Josh offers a model for prioritizing interventions that will give you the greatest benefit with the least disruption. When I first saw Josh's talk at AHS, I thought it was so important that I couldn't wait for the video to go up on YouTube. So I created a cover version. You can find that linked together with the original in the show notes for this episode that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Now, over to the interview with Dr. Josh Turknet. Well, Dr. Josh Turknet, our resident neurologist, thank you so much for joining me here at the Ancestral Health Symposium. We are on top of and the edge of the world. We've got this fantastic view of the amazing Pacific Ocean from San Diego. Quite incredible. As was your talk.
Thank you,
Josh. I thought that was absolutely fantastic.
I appreciate it.
Can you give us the title?
So the title was How to Win at Angry Birds. And the subtitle was, I don't remember. I have to look it up.
I'm sure it'll become obvious as we get further on into this talk. Talk about the premise. What's the problem? Maybe we should.
So yeah,
yeah, we should talk before we get into Angry Birds. I don't think anyone will remember the parable of Angry Birds. But get into the premise first,
or why it came about.
Yeah.
So the premise is that, so I'm a medical doctor. I graduated medical school in 2001, and over that period of time, there haven't been any significant advances in medical therapeutics. So, which pretty much means pharmaceuticals, because that's what we've been looking for. But even if you go back further, the last meaningful breakthrough, by that I mean a kind of a stepwise change from what had existed previously, whether or not it's, we'd consider it to be a clinical breakthrough, but something that was at least an order of magnitude better than something that previously existed. So the last drug that we would say meets that criteria for in neurology would be sumatriptan, which came out in 1991. And I've said that people who know me from the migraine world know that I would argue that that may have done, on balance, more harm than good. So if we go further back to the breakthrough before that, it would have been levodopa for Parkinson's, which was 1961. So if you throw out sumatriptan, we've got 50 years where we haven't seen any meaningful progress in therapeutics, and that's for neurological disease, and you can pretty much extrapolate that beyond because it applies to most of the major conditions, especially the chronic illnesses that are most of what the physician sees day in and day out these days.
So you were saying no advances in the pharmaceutical industry.
That's right. So no advances in particularly for the major chronic conditions that we see both in the neurology and general medical clinics. And I began, like I said, I began my career in 2001 with the expectation that there would probably be pretty significant progress made in the course of my career along those lines, and I think pretty much that was the prevailing belief.
Right. There's certainly no Moore's Law of pharmaceuticals, right?
No, and it may still be the prevailing belief. I mean, the strange thing is that it doesn't feel like people are reckoning with, you know, what's happened and what the facts would say that we've, despite the enormous amount of resources that we've poured into it.
Do you know what makes me really sad? I met someone recently that was doing AI drug discovery.
Oh.
So this, like, this whole new level of complexity.
Right. Right, it's like we just not smart enough, right?
Yeah,
it's like not that there's no, like, I mean, there's a lot of things that are probably keeping people from, I mean, looking at, if you figure the paradigm's wrong, then there are some implications that are tough to deal with there that you have to figure out. So, it's, and the other problem that I talked about is the way the system is set up that you can still make money off of a new drug because it doesn't have to be better than its predecessors.
Right.
Which has been all, there have been new drugs in the course of my career, but they've all been what we call Me Too drugs, where there's no meaningful difference. They have to prove.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's taken on a new meaning recently, but they don't have to be an improvement upon.
Right.
They just have to prove equivalency. So if you can find a different molecule and you know, prove it's at least as good, then you can put a marketing machine behind it and make money on it. But it does seem like that strategy is slowing down. So mm-hmm. there's been less over the past few years of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So what the fuck? What's happening?
Yeah, so what is happening? That's where Angry Birds comes in. So mm-hmm. the parable of Angry Birds is to kind of help think about why we might be seeing this spectacular failure in this particular realm. So imagine that there's alien planet and an iPhone lands there and it's loaded up with the game Angry Birds, and the aliens have no iPhones. They don't have any computers, but they're curious and competitive. So they decide that they're going to hold a competition, an Angry Birds competition. So they're going to break into two teams, mm-hmm. meet back in a month, crown one team the Angry Birds champion. Mm-hmm. So one team goes away and starts working on preparing for the competition and taking the usual approach that most of us would, which is to just play the game over and over again, get really good at it, figure out the game mechanics, figure out how to manipulate the controls. So that's their strategy. The other team goes off, and I call them team game level, but and the other team goes off, and they have a few scientists in their midst who get curious about what's underneath, and so they start taking the game apart, realizes there's a programming language, and underneath that, there's assembly language, and so ultimately, it's all just binary code that's controlling this game. So they think they've unlocked the secret. They're really excited, and they decide that their strategy is going to be figure out how can they just monkey with the machine code and play the game that way. And so they think they're going to blow the doors off the other guys. So they meet back in a month, and I think most of us would predict what would happen next. They get annihilated because unbeknownst to them at the time they decided on the strategy, it's pretty much impossible, at least in this day and age. Even the person who programmed Angry Birds would have no idea how to play it at that level and do anything meaningful in the game. In fact, nobody can look at binary code and have any clue what's happening at the level of the software or the game.
Yeah.
So that's to illustrate that. And the point there being, too, is that it's not that acquiring that knowledge of what's happening at the deeper layers isn't useful, right? It's just that we've taken the approach of thinking that intervening at that level is also the most powerful way.
Uh-huh. We put the cart in front of the horse.
Yeah, we did. So that's team source code got annihilated in our parable. And I would argue that that's the paradigm that we've been taking in medicine, is the team source code approach. And a lot of that has to do with the lure of reductionism and thinking that sort of across the board, it's a superior form of knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Where do you think, have you any idea as to where that might originate? Why are we seduced by our powers of reductionism?
Well, I mean, so we're wired to figure the world out, right? And so when we've unlocked some truth or secret that wasn't there, so I think we're driven to figure out, to acquire new forms of knowledge, and that's what that is. You know, when we're able to give a level of explanation that's beneath the level we see, it feels like you've unlocked a secret, right? So it's, in some ways, it feels natural to believe that's some superior form of knowledge and that stuff that exists above it is just an illusion.
Right.
Right. And so there's obviously, you know, if that's just the illusion, then you should play at this level. But
right.
That's why the analogy of the playing at the game, every level has its particular value and there's particular forms of knowledge that apply, that are best applied at each particular level. And it's really important to understand and get that right. But yeah, I mean, that's just why we're sort of seduced by it. And one of the motivations for putting this together initially was because I felt like, especially the ancestral health world, was taking the right kind of approach to all of this, taking an evolutionary perspective on health. But at the same time, some people or some prominent voices in that community and also in areas like functional and integrative medicine, where it's still a systems-based kind of holistic type of approach, but we're still at times seemingly seduced by reductionist kind of ideas and interventions. And I didn't want to see that happen. So,
did you throw MTHFR under the bus?
I may have.
What about nicotinamide riboside?
I just had to give a couple examples. nothing personal. And again, the point not being that those sorts of things don't have value, but it's just how do we think about our whole priorities in this realm?
Right.
How do we, you know, what do we consider to be most important? It's so easy. I mean, we like geeking out on these kinds
of things,
course. Right? So it's easy, I think, for people hearing that to get the perception that, and even themselves, but people listening as well, that because we're spending a lot of time talking about these things,
right,
that they must matter a lot or more than the basics. So that's how people get obsessed about the MTHFR or whatever, and are still not paying attention to sleep or something like that.
You know, right.
We're just flipped our priorities upside down. So it's not that these things aren't necessarily part of holistic approach to health. They're just fiddling, adjusting the margins rather than the foundation.
Right. So talk about your four quadrant model.
So I think this game level source code distinction kind of helps to, or for me, is a good way of kind of encapsulating what an evolutionary perspective applied to therapeutics looks like. So the idea was then take that and then, oh, you've got it. Great. I can cheat. So the idea was to use that idea to then kind of formalize how we think about an approach to therapies. So the four quadrants, you can imagine there's a vertical axis where you have the level of the intervention. And so the one level being the game level. So game levels, you can think of as sort of all of the evolutionary forces to which we've been adapting to for mm-hmm. the history of our species.
So go back to Angry Birds. That's the guys that just played the game.
Playing the game, right? And then you have the source code level interventions, which are things that operate oftentimes like at the cellular level.
Right. You know, tinkering with the mechanisms.
The mechanisms, neurotransmitters and enzymes and cofactors and whatnot. And then, so that's on one axis. And then on the horizontal, you have interventions that are supportive in terms of the goal. So the goal of the intervention is supportive. And in that case, thinking of it in terms of if you're trying to support what the body is already trying to do.
Right.
So you're trying to activate or amplify endogenous mechanisms for repair and recovery would be a supportive. And in the game level, that would be most of the stuff there is targeted towards minimizing mismatch.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't need as much support if we're already well matched to our environment, right? And then the other goal of intervention would be a disruptive intervention. So where we are deliberately interfering with the physiological status quo. So
okay.
We're saying things are going one way and we're going to redirect it another way because we think that's better. So why would you do that? The primary scenario would be where you have a regulatory system where you're convinced it's broken beyond repair. And that, so an example there would be giving insulin to a type 1 diabetic. So
right.
So that's the status quo is no insulin. So you're going to do something different by giving it. And then another, so I said disruptive or exploitative, and exploitative is where you're exploiting some physiological mechanism that you've understood in some capacity to promote a particular objective. So one game level type of exploitative intervention would be temperature extremes, mm-hmm. whether it's sauna or cold exposure, where you're taking what happens in the body in those conditions and then using that to improve health or enhance health in some way.
All right. So let's summarize that four quadrant model in the top left. I will, of course, link to Josh's talk. So you can see the whole talk with his slides on YouTube. Mm-hmm. That'll be live by the time you hear this. So I'll link to that in the show notes that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Or if you poke around inside of your podcast app, you'll surely find the show notes. And there'll be a hyperlink there to Josh's presentation on YouTube. But for the sake of those who are listening right now, mm-hmm. we'll summarize this four quadrant model. So in the top left hand mm-hmm. quadrant, there is
game level interventions that are supportive.
That are supportive.
So, again, the target. The
so I can think of these in terms of importance in this sequential order, right? Like these right. are things I want to worry about first.
Top left is number one.
Okay. Right. So I'm a primary care physician. Somebody just walked into my office. They're feeling tired.
Right.
The first thing I should think about is...
Right. Things like sleep, right? Sleep and then maybe their diet, right?
Right.
So, and there, the frame you're going to use is how is their sleep and their diet mismatched right now?
Right. So we're looking at this problem through the evolutionary lens.
Right.
What are the inputs this person's genes are expecting?
Right.
How do we minimize mismatch? Are they sleeping? Are they getting adequate sunshine during the day?
Right.
Are they eating a species appropriate diet? What are they drinking? Are they drinking too much caffeine? Are they drinking alcohol at night?
Right. Are they physical activity?
Physical activity. They have sufficient sleep pressure from physical activity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, right.
And then what about stress management?
Right,
overstimulation. I had trouble sleeping last night because I was just too overstimulated talking to people about ancestral health. Maybe a little bit too much caffeine as well.
Right, yep.
So that's quadrant one, minimizing mismatch.
Right.
And then do we move to quadrant two after that?
Yeah, disruptive, exploitative. Right. Game level interventions that mm-hmm. are disruptive or exploitative. Most of these, I think, we'd fall in the exploitative category, mm-hmm. at least in the way I think about them. So that would be like I said, temperature, heat, cold, different sort of physical activity that you do, like high intensity training. I would consider things like mindfulness and even psychotherapy to be game level interventions that are exploitative, fasting.
Right.
So, and the idea being that these are level two, because you'd want to pay attention to all the category one first before you add these things on top.
Right.
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 There are a few scenarios where you would not do that. And that's second in the prioritization schema. So we're prioritizing game level over source code initially.
Right.
We're going to get all of our mileage out of that first.
And there's a really good chance that if you do that, then... A
really good chance, yeah. And
fatigue is going to go away.
I would almost argue that if you just, regardless of what someone's initial complaint is, if you started with level one...
And just listen carefully to their symptoms and then ignore them.
And just implemented that, be agnostic to let the body figure it out. And then... Source then, code, yeah.
Yeah, so then we're on to the third quadrant.
Right.
And this is like the third set of things that you might think about. And these right. are source code so level into. So now back to the Angry Birds analogy. Mm-hmm. We're no longer playing the game.
Right.
We've dealt with all that, right?
Right. These are no. So another thing to map this concept of game level and source code onto the evolutionary perspective. So game level interventions are evolutionarily familiar,
mm-hmm.
right? And then source code or interventions are evolutionarily novel. And
right.
So they're also, by that nature, mismatched, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's another type of mismatch. So we've been pursuing therapies that are, by their nature, mismatched, which, of course, introduces all the same hazards and risks mm-hmm. as the very mismatched behaviors that cause the diseases to begin with. So something doesn't feel right about that either. This category is source code interventions that are supportive in nature. So, you know, probably the most common category here would be taking a supplement that's designed to correct a deficiency that you think exists. So, you know, whether it's magnesium or zinc or whatnot, you know, common things that are deficient on our diet. And for some reason, for whatever reason, you can't get it through food.
Right.
So that'd still be our preference, but there may be situations where you can't, so you supplement and that.
Right. I'm doing my best to maximize magnesium intake, but perhaps the soil is fucked. And so I need
exactly.
to take some additional.
Exactly. And then our fourth quadrant.
It's like danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Right. That's why it's in red. So it would be source code interventions that are disruptive, typically. So that would be all pharmaceuticals.
Is there really? I wondered about this. Is there really nothing?
I would love if you can think of an example. I haven't gone a long period of time trying to find one, but
right.
of the ones that I commonly use, no, I can't think of anyone that I would consider to be supportive. That's not, I mean, I don't even think we know enough. So, you know, about many of the drugs we use, we still don't even understand their mechanism.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So,
I don't think that means what you think it means.
Exactly.
I don't think that works the way you think it works.
Exactly.
The pleiotropic effects.
Right. So, to say that it would be awfully improbable if that happened to be supporting
right.
the body's trying to do it.
It might.
Have no idea what's happening.
It's like what Tommy says about EMFs. I mean, it has to do something.
Right, it
might be good.
Odds are low, but it's possible. So yeah, all pharmaceuticals I would put into that category. So and I think it's important to understand that, you know, that that's what we're doing anytime we're saying giving a prescription to a patient. It's a pretty big decision to take seriously.
Yeah, right? You're tinkering at the source code
right,
level.
Tinkering with the source code in a way that's overriding the status quo.
Yeah.
So I'm saying I'm certain that what your body's trying to do, even though I don't know what this drug does.
We're laughing, but it's...
I know, it's tragic.
So take statins as an example, HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, right? Like it's cutting this tree off.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Like all this stuff happens below,
yeah.
and the drug's going to affect all of those things.
All of those things, and we think that that's worth it.
Yeah.
So there should be an extremely high burden of proof, right, to do something like that. But anyways, that's why it's category four. And of course, the modern medicine's schema is not this, right? because...
I mean, this, you go straight to quadrant four the moment someone walks into your office.
That's right. And I think part of that stems from never having an evolutionary perspective on all of this.
Right.
If you do, I don't think you do that. I mean, there are other factors as well, but certainly that's absent. So the decision algorithm that I would give would be essentially prioritize quadrant one over quadrant two, over quadrant three, over quadrant four, unless you have convincing head-to-head evidence that says, you know, an intervention in one of the lower categories is clearly better for some particular objective than one in a higher category.
So someone walks into your office, you're going to use this as an operating procedure.
Yeah, well, this is, yeah, I mean, at least in the back of my mind, because I realized that I was using something like this already.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And
so
I just thought, what is the nature of this thing that I'm using? How could I best communicate it?
Yeah.
Because it was already there on some level. And I think having it, you know, like we talked about, we're all lured into reductionism, right?
Right.
And so I think it's a good, serves as a good reminder just to have it as a, this is my framework. This is kind of the North Star to keep myself oriented, remind myself of what I consider to be most important.
And I think it's not just useful for practitioners who are trying to figure out the operating procedure. I think it's also very useful for listeners of the podcast like me. Like when you hear someone talking about the latest pill or potion or device or hack. Simon loves the word hack.
Yeah. 100% this would be super, especially people who are in this kind of space who have decided that they needed to look elsewhere for answers. But it can be easy, even going into this world, to think that the source code is where it's at, just because we spend a lot of time talking about those things.
Right. So before you put your DNA into some filter that tells you how many eggs you should eat.
Right.
Where are we now?
So yeah, it would be incredible if every patient that walked in the door to see me already had this framework in their mind.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
So much could do. So yeah, it would be great for
listeners.
Yeah. So and it embeds a lot of the ideas that we consider or principles that we consider to be most important.
I might have to start using this language in the hope that it catches on and become trendy.
Yeah,
you know, like, so this new supplement that we're talking about, where is this? Which quadrant are we in right now?
Right, right, right. Give a label.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it's just a three. All right. I was hoping for an environmental mismatch. But.
That's right. It's not a one. I only do ones.
Yeah. And that, it's interesting because if you only do ones, then...
Yeah. I know. You may never need another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's super helpful. So, scaling.
So, one of the issues, I think there are probably multiple reasons why we haven't come to grips with this glaring problem. And one of them being an absence of an evolutionary perspective, but another one being that drugs and supplements scale very well. So,
yeah.
It's easy to build a big profitable business off of them. So, the other thing is because the randomized controlled trial has somehow become the only valid way of advancing knowledge in the realm of therapeutics, that's also limited our search to source code interventions because they're really the only thing that can be tested in that model with a randomized controlled trial. I mean, we all know how impossible it is to conduct a real decent diet therapy or any kind of game level therapy, right?
Right.
In the context of an RCT. So you've got that problem as well. So you've got this issue with how do you, and that lends to the critique about anybody who would advocate for this sort of approach to health, who would advocate for starting with diet and lifestyle, that, well, how are you going to advance that knowledge? And they'll argue if you don't have trials that it's, you know, not scientific. So,
right.
So you need to be able, you need to have solutions at scale. And you have ones that where you can validate them. You still need a research system for advancing knowledge in that realm, but it needs to be independent of randomized controlled trials. So the next thing I argued for was how to build a model that looks like that. A scalable model that can also advance knowledge in a way that's credible and scientific. And furthermore, that allows us to actually leverage the advances that we've made in science and technology towards, you know, progress in medical therapeutics. I mean, one of the most remarkable things about the fact that we've made no progress is how much progress we've made in other domains of human life and other, and just the biological sciences alone, right? I mean, think about the knowledge we have now compared to 1991, which was the last breakthrough. Why has none of that made its way into therapeutics, right? Why has none of that translated into improvements despite its exponential growth? So to having a model that allows us to apply those advances to the development of medical therapeutics. So you take basically, how do you play any game, right? Which is you play, you take an action in the game, right? Then you get feedback from what happened, right? And then you compare that to what your objective is, and you refine your approach, and you take another action. And that's how you learn the game, and that's how you acquire knowledge about game level interventions. And almost all of what we know about what we consider to be ground truths in human health was not acquired through randomized controlled trials. You know, it was acquired through other forms of other ways of acquiring knowledge. So we need to allow for that and figure out how to formalize that into a research ecosystem. So yeah, in the talk that I gave, that, you know, examples of how you can apply the tools of science and technology at each level in that process of playing the game, assessing the results, refining accordingly, and playing again. So you can, all gameplay that works, and that's how you create this virtuous cycle of continuous improvement, right? Like, we don't, even in the best of scenarios right now, even if you come up with a good drug, you're then stuck waiting for the next drug to make another improvement, right? You don't have any real mechanism for making that an iterative, continuous process. Nor do you have any mechanism for understanding individual variations in how therapies work or contextual dependencies, right? If the patient has, you know, what's the context of saturated fat in the context of someone eating a low carbohydrate diet versus a high carb diet? We have no real way of understanding those contextual dependencies right now, and so we act like they don't exist.
Right. Well, there's companies doing that kind of stuff, right? Like, can I use your genetic data to understand drug metabolism to make a more targeted approach? Which is like kind of source code level interventions on top of source code level interventions.
Exactly, right. And we could be so much better at getting that kind of knowledge if we just changed how we thought about it.
So the right way to do things is the same way that you learn to play anything, right? How do you learn how to play tennis, right?
Exactly.
I hit the ball. Where did it land? Oh, that one went a bit long. Let me try hitting it slightly differently. Oh, yeah, that one went a bit shorter, but that's too short now.
Right.
Let's try a third time. Oh, that's just right. Like, let's learn how you learn to play anything.
Right.
You have this feedback
loop, and you're acquiring knowledge about the game itself, right?
Right.
And there are layers of explanation about the game that exist beneath that game level. You could start looking into the physics of, you know, hitting a tennis ball or aerodynamics of ball flight, and it would certainly be other applications for that knowledge, but it wouldn't help you in playing the game anymore.
Right.
So understanding it. And that's another thing that I talked about, is that I think what we need to do is completely dissociate how we research therapeutic knowledge versus mechanistic knowledge, how things work, rather than trying to kind of do both at the same time.
Figure out what works before you figure out how it works.
Right. What works can certainly help us to figure out mechanisms, and then ultimately that can possibly enhance either our interventions, or right now I would say the best place to apply our source code knowledge of mechanisms is in monitoring, you know, assessing our interventions. So looking at disease markers, looking at labs and imaging to know our game level interventions moving us towards an objective, particularly talking about, you know, treating a particular disease.
Right. As you know, I'm a particularly big fan of this, and that was, has been my complaint for a while, is that you generally don't get that feedback.
Right.
And Malcolm Kendrick talked about how in cardiovascular disease, quite often the first symptom is death.
Exactly.
That's too late. I need to know before then.
Exactly.
That my vegetarian diet's not working. And maybe a vegetarian diet could work if it was done really well, and appropriate feedback would tell you as such.
There are lots of questions that we would love to know, right?
Yeah.
And we have the tools to figure this out. We have the tools to do this.
There's just so much dipshittery and uncertainty that's created by not having any way to assess that, though. You know, even here at the Ancestral Health Symposium, you know, you hear someone propose some idea. Well, that's interesting. I quite like to explore that. But how do I assess that it's working? What do I wait?
Right.
Like, maybe there's even transgenerational effects. So maybe my great-great-grandchildren will tell me whether that was a good decision or not.
Right, right. And in the meantime, you play the game, you get level one taken care of, right? There are certain things we have to acknowledge that the limits of what we know, right?
Yeah. Be okay with not knowing.
We're so bad at that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why if saying we don't have a robust mechanistic explanation of how a particular intervention works is seen as undermining it somehow, when it's not in any respect, but we're so hung up on thinking that that's needed.
There are certain humbling things, or at least things that I find humbling, that make you, made me realize that there's just certain things I can't understand. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I've just finished reading Dave Deamer's book on the origins of life. And I found it a little bit frustrating because I felt like he was just moving the problem around. Like, what happened with the origins of life? And it's, he relies on stuff turning up from outer space on comets and
right.
Like, there's this fat, there just happens to be the right fatty acids in this comet. You can put it in a blender and you'll get C8
right
coconut oil out of it. Okay, all right, so what happened before the Big Bang?
Right.
What did happen before the Big Bang? That's an interesting question. You Google it and it turns out that asking what is before the Big Bang is like asking what's south of the South Pole. It's just
right.
Like,
you understand there's actually nothing at the bottom, right?
Yeah, I'm like, oh, I guess I just can't understand that.
Yes,
like,
right.
I just don't have the apparatus to...
Right, and that there are certain things that are just assumptions that you just have to grant. You
know? Yeah. But does there become any value in it? That's like a kind of interesting question as well. It's like once you know that something works, mm-hmm. and you're comfortable with not knowing mm-hmm. how it works, is there any value
in exploring it?
In exploring it to find out the details, the technical details,
I mean,
the source code.
I guess it does, because it reveals, I mean, it's something that, if something works that you didn't know worked before.
Go
so
on.
When you find something that works that didn't work before and is surprising, right?
Mm.
Then clearly there's some knowledge to be gained there, right? You didn't understand and potentially.
Oh, well, so maybe that insight gives new insights into what else might work, right?
Right, for sure. And then exploring, then figuring out how it works could still lead to other valuable information. It's kind of like there is value in just exploring curiosity about the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many of our advances that we've made, major technological advances, just started
yeah,
from someone
course.
Just, what the heck was this? And had no idea it would one day turn into some magnificent technology. But so there's certainly value in that. It's, for me, it's simply, it's the primary take-home message is understanding where it applies, what it's good to use for and what it isn't.
And it's a false dichotomy to say it's an either or, right?
For sure, yeah.
You don't have to, this doesn't mean that you can't investigate mechanisms and tinker around at the source code level. It's just that...
Absolutely.
First, you must play the game.
Right, yeah. Either or thinking is another huge issue that's plagued us. I was thinking about that with the talk because, you know, I use Alzheimer's as one of the poster children for this insanity, right? How many resources we've poured into it and have come up empty, and despite how much hype there was, it was around it. And you had for years people debating, you know, is it amyloid or is it tau? As
right.
if like ever is as if A, it had to be either or, right? Why we ever thought that? I don't know.
Yeah.
And B, as if the fate of what happened, whether our success depended on which one we got right, because it's going to be one of those two.
Yeah,
you know?
Those. I mean, those models, they always make me like, I mean, we've seen it before, like you say, in the integrative like field. Like, I mean, Bredesen has it, is it glycotoxic or is it toxic,
right.
or is it insulin resistant or is it like, and it's like, it's great, it like it's kind of catchy and like, oh, this is the system I can get.
Right.
And then Mickey mentioned Gretchen Rubin's like tendencies. Am I a questioner or am I a thinker?
Right.
As if you could like, you couldn't be two at once, like,
right.
it wouldn't change for different situations.
Right.
And
they're cognitive heuristics, but they're not like truth, you know? It's like, well, we mistake them for that, yeah.
So how do we spread the word?
Yeah,
I keep coming up with this idea for TED Talk. you might have to get rid of me and distill it down a bit.
Right.
In order for it to be...
18 minutes long.
18 minutes long.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about this wherever anybody will have me, but yeah. People can watch the YouTube video and share that too. And yeah, get in touch if anybody wants to help spread the word, help share the message.
And then maybe one thing you do is listen to the Intelligence Unshackled podcast.
Oh, of course you can. Yeah.
I've very much been enjoying the Intelligence Unshackled podcast. It's one of my favorites.
Excellent. Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Yep. So
for the one person that's left that doesn't know about the Intelligence Unshackled podcast.
That's right. I didn't know there were any. So yeah, it's obviously related to some of these ideas. So I'm a neurologist, and so human intelligence is one of my interests, and as is realizing human potential by helping people to get more out of their brains. So the unshackled refers to the fact that human intelligence and our brain and cognitive function is constrained in multiple ways in our current modern environment, and that's both, at least pertaining to this discussion, you know, one of those constraints is compromises in its biological function. So our intelligence and our cognition is ultimately the result of an organ, and it's important that organ functions well if we want to improve our intelligence and cognition. So, and the primary constraints, I would argue, arise from mismatches. So just like with other domains of health, the easy wins for improving cognition are first taking care of mismatches. People who've been through it understand the difference between suboptimal and optimal sleep, right? So just getting things like that dialed in makes a huge difference in cognition. So yeah, the mission of that is to explore all the ways that we might cultivate and improve human intelligence, and starting with removing the collective shackles, which, like I said, we have the biological ones, and then the software side as well, which is our capacity to learn and add new skills and capabilities as we or throughout our lives. And there are several ways in which that's constrained as well, starting with some limiting beliefs that have been handed down to us for a long time and that are still fairly pervasive.
Very relevant to anyone interested in improving their cognition, but also interesting for people who are interested in education, which is basically everyone with kids, right?
I really
enjoyed the first do no harm approach to education. I'll resist the temptation to get into that here, but instead defer people to the Intelligence Unshackled podcast. I was listening to that on a plane, and I made Julie put on my noise cancelling headphones so that she could hear that section on the first do no harm.
First do no harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get out of the brain's way.
Yeah. I really enjoy that style where you as a neurologist tell that story that you might call a case study.
Right.
That presents this interesting example, like what might be going on here, like as a detective. And then of course you have the answer, but you kind of have to wait and get the explanation. Like I do enjoy that style. It's very well done.
Thank you. Yeah, we're curious creatures, so if you can arouse curiosity, keep a listener around, hopefully.
And then if you want to support Josh on Patreon, you can do so by, what's the best link for people to go to find you on Patreon?
The best link is to go to elitecognition.com. There's information there about joining the Brain Joe Collective. And so if you want to become part of that and support on Patreon, you can do that. And we've got the private forum for members of the collective along with the brain fitness challenges.
I love that forum. It was Simon's idea, actually, when we started that. So we've got quite a diverse group of users. And it was Simon's idea some time ago. And it now gets 10,000 page views a month. What the heck?
Wow.
Yeah. There's Fantastic. A lot. I think there's a lot of people interacting, but there's a lot of people just reading stuff, I think.
Yeah.
So Josh has been posting these lessons that will teach you how to play the ukulele as a perk of being part of the Brain Joe Collective. And I'm still on lesson three. Still on lesson three. join Josh on the Intelligence Unshackled podcast and as part of the Brain Joe Collective. Is there anything I forgot about? Oh, and if you know anyone with a migraine, where'd you send them?
Go to mymigrainemiracle.com.
Just chips off the tongue. My migraine miracle. I love it. Is there anything else people should know about Josh?
I think that's good. We've given him enough.
Okay. Right. Well, thank you for suffering my infliction of the environmental mismatch that is recording podcasts at 20 to 9 p.m. It's dark as we're now stood here on top of the apartment in San Diego. It's been a fantastic ancestral health symposium. We just found out that there's not going to be one next year, but the year after that's going to be in L.A.
Yeah,
UCLA. So maybe we'll see you in a couple of years' time in Southern California.
Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Thanks, Josh.
You're welcome.